You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Catherine Stoner, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Spogli Institute and a Senior Fellow. Have you ever looked at an outdated world map and noticed how many countries no longer exist? Have you done it recently? Well, here's an interesting fact for you. Only three countries have been created in the 21st century. While there are secessionist and independent movements all over the globe, the truth is that the world map has become surprisingly static. At the same time, there are numerous examples of people who are living under semi-sovereign conditions, not quite countries and not quite colonies. What makes a country a country? Why has it become harder to form new countries? And are we likely to see the world map become locked in place? Or is this current moment just an anomaly? Well, today on the show, we're joined by Joshua Keating. He's a foreign policy analyst and a staff writer at Slate magazine. And he recently wrote a book called Invisible Countries, Journeys to the Edge of Nationhood. Josh, welcome to Stanford and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll start with the question I think most people want to know when somebody sits down and writes a book is why? Why did you do it? And this is a really interesting topic, and the way you start the book is really interesting with discussion of who has a soccer team. Mm. So what got you thinking about borders and sovereignty and how countries are created? And why did you want to write this book in particular?
Well, it's been kind of a theme that I've been pursuing for a while. I first started looking at the question of what is a country, I'd say around the time Kosovo declared independence and was recognized by quite a few countries, but not, you know, hasn't quite reached the level of UN member state status. That's because of Russia's opposition mainly.
So late 1990s then?
Or early? Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, or early 2000s.
Early 2000s, yeah.
And it's kind of been I've been interested for a while in unrecognized states and sort of semi-sovereign territories. And so I sort of wanted to explore this in a little more depth and take some time and look at some places that are maybe not in the news as often and places where our kind of usual ideas about what a country is break down. And as you mentioned, the kind of framing device I use for the book is this soccer tournament, which was held in 2016 in Abkhazia, breakaway region of Georgia. And this was a soccer tournament for unrecognized countries, meaning the kind of places that don't have enough of country status to make it into the World Cup that just concluded.
Interesting. So this may sound like a simple question then, but what exactly is a country? Soccer team seems to be an important marker for some, from what you're saying about your experience in going to Abkhazia and watching this different kind of World Cup. Is there a universal agreed upon definition? There's obviously a big academic literature on sovereignty and what a sovereign state is. But how have you engaged with that? Your book is much more accessible than a typical academic book on sovereignty.
Yeah, the rock musician Frank Zappa once joked that the things you need to have a country are a beer, an airline, and a soccer team. So a lot of these places had at least one of the three.
Although the U.S. didn't, well, we have a soccer team, but not World Cup worthy, I guess, but still.
But yeah, I mean, there is a kind of generally accepted legal definition. It's you can find it in a treaty called the Montevideo Convention,
right?
Which I heard a lot about everywhere I went to. People would trot out the Montevideo criteria, which are to be an independent state, you have to have a government, permanent population, defined borders, and the capacity to enter into relations with other states. Now, that sounds simple enough, but there are plenty of places in the world that are recognized as UN, as states that have that placard in the UN General Assembly that don't quite meet these criteria. And there are plenty of places, like some of the places I went to, that do meet these criteria and are not generally recognized. So, I mean, I guess really
It's squishy.
It's squishy. The more it's one of these things where the more you try to define it, the more the rules kind of break down.
You know it when you see it, but it's
exactly
right. So, you know, when you think about borders, well, what if you can't actually protect those borders or defend those borders? And obviously, there's lots of conversation about that here in the United States with respect to immigration, but there is also in other parts of the world, too. So how strong do those borders have to be a country? And when you think about Abkhazia, and I confessed to you earlier that I'm a Russia specialist, so we watch Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and which some would say are part, well, most would say, in fact, are part of Georgia.
Yeah.
They think they're independent. Others would say they're part of Russia, and certainly their border is their borders are protected by Russia.
Yeah, I can say having crossed that border, that's very much the case. It's a sort of strange place to get into. I went from the Georgian side, and you kind of get to this police checkpoint, a Georgian police checkpoint, which you are not to call a border when you're crossing it. And then you kind of walk a kilometer across this potholed road that neither country is really maintaining.
You actually literally have to walk.
To walk. There are horse-drawn carts that will pick up your luggage for you if you're bringing bags. And then you get to the fenced-off Abkhazian border. Call it what you want, but it's pretty real once you see it, which is protected by the FSB, the Russian Internal Security Service, who question you upon entering. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, as the president has recently tweeted, to have a country, you have to have borders.
And that's President of the United States,
Donald Trump, yeah. And, you know, to a certain extent, that of course, that's true. That's a truism. But, you know, I think that for plenty of the places in the world, that doesn't mean that these borders are completely impassable or that these countries are hermetically sealed and that there's complete control over who and what enters at any given time.
Right, right. Although in that case, unlike in the U.S. case, there's another country protecting the borders of Abkhazia, not you know, it's not that it's just that it's permeable. In fact, it's almost impermeable.
Right. And Abkhazia is viewed by the rest of the world as, or with the exception of two or three other countries, as Russian-occupied Georgian territory, essentially. You know, it's funny when you talk to people there, they're very adamant that that's not the case, that they see themselves as an independent nation and the Russian military presence as this kind of necessary evil that they have to tolerate in order to, you know, keep the Georgians out, essentially.
Right.
And so it's, well, when you're there, you feel very much like you're in an independent state, but viewed from the outside, it's certainly obvious to see why it's viewed as essentially Russian territory.
Uh-huh, right. So there are lots of examples that you cite in the book on territories that seem like they're on the verge of creating an independent state, or at least trying to do so but are unable to do so. So, you know, we think of Kurdistan in northern Iraq, Scotland, which has held a referendum. I will also confess that I'm Canadian as well as American. I'm a dual citizen, so Quebec from time to time has tried to do that. Catalonia, Palestine, and Taiwan. So the history of each of these places is unique. But are there common and surprising themes that you discovered? Are there, you know, independence movements that develop indigenously? Is it based on language? Why do people want to sort of declare themselves independent? Is there sort of a generalizable, or what is generalizable, if anything?
I'd say the commonality I found is that when you talk to officials or even just regular people in any of these countries, you always hear that it's sort of historically inevitable, that it's historically just that they should be a country. And to them, it seems obvious. And they can always point to, you know, four or five examples of places that are, you know, less worthy of countryhood than they are. And, you know, while it makes sense when you're there, the world unfortunately doesn't really work that way. And as we mentioned before, there's not really a common criteria. And the world map has become relatively frozen in place, and it's difficult to create new countries now. And there are enormous obstacles to any independence movement. And that being said, the reasons, these sort of justifications differ a lot from place to place. I mean, if you take Kurdistan, that's a place where they view themselves as a nation without a state. It's a cultural group that's divided between four different countries in the Middle East and believe that they should have a nation state. Somaliland, where I went to, which is in northern Somalia, they're actually trying to reimpose the colonial borders. This was what was formerly the British part of Greater Somalia. And despite being pretty similar in terms of language and culture to the people in the rest of Somalia, they would want to redraw that border and use that as the basis for their national legitimacy.
Huh, interesting. So one thing I wanted to ask you about was the role of violence in these places trying to establish themselves as states. So there's the concept of the state, which is more geographic, and then the concept of the nation, which is perhaps more cultural and, you know, feeling yourself to be a Quebecer mm-hmm. or to be, a Kurd or a Scot. Is violence something that's necessary? Some of the places that you talk about, there has been violence. And I'm thinking of, and again, because I'm an academic, I'm thinking of the sort of classic thing we always teach is the Charles Tilly book about, and his line, states make war and war makes states. And that's because they create an infrastructure of taxation and in particular, and then are able to defend and establish those borders from a capital. So is violence an important role or commonality in these countries?
Yeah, and you could look at the other classic definition of a state, which is Max Weber's control of the legitimate use of violence of force mm-hmm. in a given territory, and that clearly that does play a role, and usually when borders have changed historically, it has been accompanied by violence. And in this period of stasis that I'm talking about, where the world map has stayed relatively fixed in place, it's probably not a coincidence that it's been a relatively peaceful period in terms of interstate war. I mean, obviously, there's no shortage of conflicts we can point to around the world today. But, you know, examples of governments going to war against each other over territory, that's become pretty rare, which is an anomaly, I'd say, in most of recent human history.
Although we have Ukraine, we have Kosovo, we have...
And Ukraine, and I think that's one of the reasons the annexation was obviously such a shock.
And Georgia.
Was the forceful redrawing of, or attempt to redraw a border within Europe, which is something that hadn't been seen in decades.
Right. And of course, a lot of these countries don't, getting back to our original or our earlier discussion of Abkhazia, mm-hmm. and you're crossing the border. It's a border maintained by Russia. So when you think of the Weberian definition of a state, you know that they clearly don't have a monopoly on the legitimate use of force.
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
So, but others of these places may have more of that.
The other example you could talk about, Kurdistan does have its own fighting force, its own military, and does, to a certain degree, protect its borders, although those borders were recently pushed back by the Iraqi state. But, that could be an example of a place that does more or less control the monopoly force on its territory and yet is not generally recognized as an independent state.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, right. So some of them are closer in that respect than others. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the role of ethnicity in establishing, nationalism, and that can be a driver, of course, for demand for an independent country or state. So given that a lot of African states in particular were established through colonialism, is it sort of natural to have more demands for secession in the wake of that and in the wake of the collapse of empires? I'm thinking of the Soviet Union as well. Is it something that's, likely to happen more in the future or less, do you think?
Yeah, well, you mentioned in the introduction the relatively few countries that have been created recently. I mean, the big wave of country creation when most of the 193 or 194, depending on how you define it, countries we have in the world today were created during the wave of decolonization.
In the 1960s.
Yes, 1970s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And But, you know, there was a kind of consensus even while that process was taking place that the borders that existed upon independence were not going to be questioned. You know, you can look in the charter of the African Union, which is a organization that's just to some extent its express purpose is rejecting the legacy of colonialism, and yet it has language in its charter saying that borders that exist upon independence won't be changed. And you could say that's a bit contradictory, because, you know, what could be a larger vestige of colonialism than the actual shape of the countries that were drawn by colonial right. powers? But
so often completely arbitrarily,
right? And and there's sort of economists who talk about the difference between straight and squiggly borders as a kind of measure of how artificial they are. Clearly, I mean, if you look at the kind of countries of the world as a club, it doesn't like to admit new members, and it doesn't like to see territorial adjustments, and there's a resistance to kind of opening the floodgates to redrawing of borders for pretty obvious reasons.
Right. So you're not predicting any new states popping up anytime soon that actually meet the criteria that we've mapped out either through Weber or the Montevideo agreement.
It's funny, like when I started the book, I was perhaps thinking it was a little more likely that this period of stasis was coming to an end. I mean, it was sort of around 2014, so you had the annexation of Crimea, you had the emergence of the Islamic State in Iraq, which was casting doubt on borders there. Kurdish independence looked more likely. There was a lot of coverage of China's building of artificial islands in the South China Sea, expanding its territorial claims. So at the time, Scottish nationalism, Catalonian nationalism. Mm-hmm. So at the time, I was kind of thinking that maybe this period of stasis was ending. But, you know, 4 years later, the world map is looking a lot more robust, I have to say. And the Crimean example aside, which is a sort of obvious anomaly or counterexample to all these broad statements I'm making.
But, well, so it's not. It's soaked into another country. It's been sucked into another country. So.
Yeah, but that aside, I mean, I'd say that large territorial adjustments, either in terms of new countries being carved out or, you know, territorial conflicts resulting in reapportionment of territory, that seems pretty unlikely for now.
Okay, so wanted to ask you, just because some of our listeners are sometimes students at Stanford here and also some folks who might be coming back to graduate school, what was your path into studying foreign policy? Because I know you've worked for Foreign Policy Magazine. Now you're at Slate. How did you fall into or get interested in international affairs?
Sure. I mean, it started as an undergrad. I went to Oberlin College and I was a politics major there who spent most of my time working on the newspaper. But I also I studied Russian and was at for a time that was kind of the main area of the world I was interested in.
It still is for those of us who study it.
We're back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's great. It's good times to be in the Russia business, I would imagine. So right out of college, I started working at Foreign Policy. And have been on that path ever since. And I've kind of found it a good way to continue to study these questions. And I've never kind of done sort of traditional beat reporting. It's always been either blogging or magazine writing, which lets me get a little more conceptual. And even though I'm not an academic by any means, I get to kind of engage with these ideas in my own way.
Uh-huh. That's great. Well, we've pretty much run out of time, I think, at this point, but I wanted to thank you very much for joining us today on World Class. Thank you so much for coming to Stanford. We've been talking to Joshua Keating. He's a foreign policy analyst and a staff writer at Slate Magazine, and he recently wrote a book called Invisible Countries, Journeys to the Edge of Nationhood, and it's available on Amazon, as pretty much everything is, from Yale University Press.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.